Keeping cut flowers looking vibrant and fresh can be a challenge, but in December, many of us take on a much larger challenge when we cut down a tree and bring it into the living room. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here to talk about Christmas trees. We'll find out how to grow them, how to pick the perfect one, and how to take care of it once you get it home. Chris Curry, horticulturist at Iowa State University, will also be here to teach us about the strange and beautiful poinsettia plant. And Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension will also be here to answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and holiday plants are an important part of the holiday season. Today, we'll talk about two of the most iconic holiday plants, the Christmas tree and the poinsettia. Chris Curry, assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, will be here in a little while to teach us all about the poinsettia. But we're going to start with the trees, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Now, I realize a lot of people have already gone out and gotten their trees this year. And if you were hoping to go out to a Christmas tree farm, it's not exactly drag it through the snow kind of experience
year. Iced tea and a Christmas tree? What do you
right. Exactly. But I realize that a lot of people have already had that experience. But I think it's important to think about what goes into growing a Christmas tree when we buy one of these trees, whether it's at a lot in town or whether we go out to a Christmas tree farm. Most of the time, how old are Christmas trees before they're cut?
Well, a lot of that, Charity, depends on species. Some species grow faster than others. But if you look at the national average, they generally say about 7 years for a Christmas tree. But I would say your range is probably 7 to 12 or 7 to 15, depending on what size you're getting and what species you're growing. So it does take a lot of work. It takes a lot of planning. It takes an open area where you have good soils. You can't just plant them anywhere. Can't, in most cases, these are evergreen trees, so it has to be a moist but well-drained soil. It can't be too sandy for most species, especially the firs. They don't like a real sandy soil. So you need a pretty decent site to be able to grow these trees. And you need some space because depending on how many you want to put per acre, we may plant 500 to 1,000 trees per acre for Christmas trees, depending on your spacing and your rows and all that. So just the initial cost to get to that 7 years is very high because, again, you have to have the land, which last time I checked, crop land and decent land was not cheap, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars an acre if a person wants to get started. And then the trees themselves, you may pay 50 cents up to a couple dollars per tree, per seedling, to get that started. And as we learned in 2012 and 2008, all those trees don't survive either. So it's constant replanting because basically if you get gaps in your field, those are years that you may not have as many trees as you want. So you have to continue to maintain those trees. And we don't just plant those trees and then walk away.
Right. I was going to ask you.
Right. We don't say, okay, we'll see you in 8 years. We'll come and cut you. Have a great time. We'll be back. It doesn't work that way. It takes mowing. It takes weed control. And weed control can be herbicides like cultivation, sometimes fertilization, depending on the soil conditions. And we do have pests. We have different insects and different diseases that may take, at least at a minimum, we have to monitor those pests year in and year out to make sure that they don't cause damage to our trees.
And do you have to irrigate in the first couple of years?
Well, if we have good weed control, no. And that's really where you want a good site. If you have a good site with good soil retaining ability or moisture retaining ability, and you pick the right species based on that soil condition. If you do good weed control, in most cases, you don't have to do a ton of supplemental watering. But like in 2012, where we kind of had the drought and things were really dry, I know growers that were watering and they still couldn't keep the trees alive. It just was so dry that even with supplemental watering, they were having a tough time. Most growers that I've worked with and that I know, they use weed control, like I say, either mulch, light cultivation, herbicides, to basically kill either a strip on 1 or 2 foot on each side of that tree, so they have a 2 or 4 foot strip kind of weed-free, and that's grass-free. But then they have grass in between the rows for maintenance and stuff like that. Or they use circles, like a 2 to 3 foot circle, basically, of no weeds. If we do that, those trees can basically take advantage of any moisture that comes. There's less competition with the adjoining grasses and stuff like that. And you can get pretty good survival without supplemental watering. So that's where the planning and all that is real critical. Then we throw these other things in there. Gophers, mice, moles, and deer. There's so many different things that rabbits early on. And then as we develop those trees, if we can keep those guys away, which sometimes takes 15-foot fence, 8-foot fence, electric fence, you know, all kinds of different things, repellents, whatever, noises, right. You know, good hunting management. It again, takes a lot of things to keep those critters out of there. But then if you keep all those things away and the trees grow, again, they don't turn into a nice 7-foot Christmas tree without some other management.
So and do you need to shape them as
yes,
they grow?
Yes, we do. So if we just let them grow, it'd be like if you never cut your hair, it might look a little wild. And people seem, most people, like this kind of manicured, more pyramidal shape form. Mm-hmm. You see kind of different variations, some wider, some more narrow than others, some more upright. But you need some shearing. So it actually utilizes a shearing knife, or there's different blades they use. But usually once those trees are growing 8 to 12 inches in a year, the shoot growth, then you have to start shaping that tree. So in the first couple years, you usually don't do much shearing. But you may do some staking and some guying to keep one straight leader, or if you get a bird that plops on that top and breaks off the top, and then you got two leaders, you got to train one leader. Some people use little mini stakes that kind of keep the trees straight. And then as those trees develop, you often prune a handle. So because, you know, we got to get packages underneath the tree.
Right.
So most of us don't want our Christmas tree clear down on the ground. So somebody's got to prune those branches up over time so we kind of have that handle when it comes time to harvesting. But most trees are probably going to be, you know, starting year 4 or 5 are going to be sheared. So you're going to shear them 3, 4, 5, 6 years before you get to that. And depending on species, that shearing period isn't tremendously long. Like with pines, you usually got to get them done by the middle of the summer because you shear them so that they set new buds. Because they actually set new buds on the tips where you shear. And if you shear too early, those buds won't develop well. If you shear too late, those buds won't develop. So timing is really important. You don't have a huge window in the midsummer, but usually mid-June, by July 1st, you want to have that shearing done. With some of the other evergreens, like the firs, their buds, they have buds all up and down the branch. So you can prune at different times and shear at different times so you have a bigger window to shear those. So it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to get to that year 8 to get that benefit. Yeah.
Now, there are trends in Christmas trees. I've noticed that the different species have been popular at different times in my life. Are Christmas tree farmers driving that or responding to that? Because I imagine that if you plant a tree and you wait 6 years or 8 years to harvest it,
right,
you don't have a lot of control over
right.
what the consumers are going to want at the end of that time.
Most of the growers I work with, again, are kind of responding to their clients. I help at a local farm, and I've noticed over the last 8, 9 years, there's just been a huge demand for firs. Everybody wants firs. And it used to be white pine and scotch pine, and there are still, you know, some of those that still like the pines, but there really has seemed to be a shift to firs. The one challenge with that is some of our sites and some of the sites out there, if they're a little sandier or they don't have a good north-facing slope and they're not cool and they're south or southwest-facing, they don't grow the firs as well. So some growers are actually contracting with growers in the north in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and they'll bring in firs just so that their clients get what they want. It's funny. We'll have people that come in that I work with, and every year they come to the pre-cuts. They don't want to cut their own, so they'll come in, they'll spend their time, they'll pick that tree, they'll get it on the car, and then they'll go walk out in the field for an hour just to experience the field. Well, we're not going to cut one, but we just want to walk and enjoy the environment. Kids want to run around, and this is why we come to the farm. We're not going to get one out there because we love that fir, but we want to go out and enjoy the farm. So you get all different, you know, sorts. And the neat thing I've observed is people are bringing back traditions. I have seen over the last 8 to 9 years little babies that I'm now seeing. They're 8, 9, 10 years old, making me feel old. But I'm watching these kids get out of the car every year, you know, and
get
they're
the
a little
same
bigger.
Picture.
Yeah, and, yep. The same family. Now there's 5 of them, you know, or 6. And it's like, oh, my gosh, you know, and I've. You know, I saw you when you're in your mom's belly 3 years ago. Now look at you, you know, and it's people say that we're trying to bring back tradition to our family and stuff. And Christmas trees is one of those traditions that people like to bring back.
All right. Well, we're nearly to the break, but just a little quick advice.
Okay.
So once you bring the Christmas tree home, what's the best way to get it set up and have a successful,
well,
not if, dried out Christmas tree?
You know, if you get it, we always talk about this. If you cut it fresh at the farm, you know, you usually have a couple hours as long as you don't stick it back in mud or anything like that. You shouldn't have to fresh cut it. You could get it right up, get it in water. If you have a tree that maybe was pre-cut and they didn't cut it, you want to take a half inch to an inch off, get a good, nice, fresh cut, and then get it up right away. You see different things about how hot should the water be and stuff like that. Just get it in water. If you want it a little warmer,
keep that water full because it's going to drink a lot right at the start, right?
I actually was telling somebody this morning, we put our tree up Friday night, and it was drinking 3 or 4 inches a day out of our little well. So it was drinking basically a gulp full cup. I've put a gulp full cup in our stand every day for the last 5 days and don't have a heat source near it. So I go in and close all my vents, you know, around the Christmas tree, stuff like that. But again, don't let that water run out. That's
right.
Key.
And if it gets down below the level, the tree's going to stop drinking, right? You can't
basically
just fill it up again.
If it's later, you know, towards the end of Christmas, you know, it'll probably last another week or two and won't be a big problem. But if it really runs out early, you might have to pull it out, recut it, and set it back again.
All right.
fun.
Right. I can't see that happening. All right. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We've been talking about Christmas trees. We're going to talk about poinsettia. And we're also going to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. In this hour, we're focusing on holiday plants, but of course, we're also here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here, also joining us now, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State and also our poinsettia expert of the day. Hello, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. And let's field a couple of questions first, and then we'll talk about those strange and beautiful poinsettia plants. Katrina's on the line first from Dubuque. Hi, Katrina.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I know this isn't about a Christmas plant. It's actually more an Easter plant. My redbud tree, it's losing its bark. It looks like it's just coming off in patches. It's got a big patch left on one side and a couple patches left on the other side. The tree's about 16 years old, and it looks very healthy otherwise. Any ideas why or what I can do to save?
Near the base of the trunk?
Yes.
Okay. And it's kind of a, you're starting to see kind of a reddish tint to the bark as that bark peels off?
Yeah, what's left is not, it's not raw, it's just brown, but it's not the same heavy, thick bark.
I think Richard and I are going the same way.
Yes, I think so.
As red buds get bigger, they actually get some flaky bark, and you should see that on the lower portion. If you look up on the branches, the bark should still be smooth, but as you come down towards the trunk, it's going to start flaking and kind of peeling. And that's actually one of the neat kind of winter characteristics of red bud. When you get some snow and stuff, that kind of glares off the snow and gives you some landscape characteristic and winter characteristic. But if the bark, if you're seeing white underneath, then I think you have an issue. But if it's usually kind of a, more of a reddish tint, and you can kind of take your hand, it seems like it's just kind of, the outer part is just kind of scaling. I think you're just looking at normal bark development on that red bud.
Oh, good. Good, good.
Wonderful news. All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Katrina. And Gary from Sheridan has a question I know you've answered before, Richard, so we'll do it again. Hello, Gary.
Hello. I moved here from California, and folks tell me that those hedge balls will chase the spiders away. Is that true?
Richard?
Basically, no. You can kill one if you drop it on it, but that's about all you can do. There's a lot of myths associated with the hedge apple that it will keep out, for example, spiders or rodents and things like that. But there's really no scientific basis for that. There might be some chemical in the actual hedge ball that, if it were developed, might maybe deter some insects. But just having a hedge ball, let's say in the basement or in the corner of a room, is not going to keep out spiders, no.
I have 12 of them in my basement, and they're going today.
Okay. Well, you can put one or two upstairs. They're kind of attractive. You could put them with an arrangement where you might have some gourds, Indian corn, that type of thing. They're kind of attractive, but...
Or you can gift them to the squirrels.
Yes, you can.
Okay, I'll do that.
All right. Gary, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I have this email from Andrew who... He said, growing up, we always used Iowa's native tree, the red cedar, as our Christmas tree. I loved them, but always remember months later getting the needles stuck in a bare foot, just that one needle left behind embedded in the carpet.
They are very prickly, yes.
All right, let's talk about poinsettias for a little while, Chris. And last year we had you on the program to explore the history of this remarkable plant, and it's such an amazing history. So where does it come from?
It's going to be native to southern Mexico and Guatemala.
All right, and so if you were in southern Mexico or Guatemala, you would see these plants just growing?
Yeah, they'd be growing. You know, they're a shrub in the wild, so they tend to be a much larger form than, of course, you're seeing on your desk or on your table. They can reach up to 20 feet in height, and it can be pretty impressive. I haven't seen them in Mexico, but I have seen large specimens grown out in the wild in the mountains of Thailand, actually, and that was pretty interesting to see.
And if I saw one of these 20-foot poinsettia plants, would I recognize it?
You would probably say, that looks like a poinsettia, but it can't be. But it actually would, if it were in flower and you had those bright, colorful bracts on top of the plant.
All right. So the coloration is similar to what we see in the ones that we buy in the store?
Well, with the red ones... correct. That's going to be the natural color of the poinsettia. But breeders have done quite a good job expanding that color palette. So now we've got the red, and we've got variation on the red, the dark red, the plum, the burgundy. We also have pink. We've got white. We've got sort of a cinnamon color. We even have something that's called a glitter color bract. And I'm not referring to the ones that are spray painted and literally have glitter, but these are... natural colors, but it looks like a Jackson Pollock painting, like someone was just smattering paint onto those bracts. And that's a natural coloration from the plant. We also have seen, you don't see them at this time of year, it's passed a little bit, but those orange poinsettias are starting to come on the market as well.
So when did the poinsettia start to make the journey from the wilds of Guatemala or southern Mexico to our stores in the United States?
Well, it really started back in the sort of mid-1800s, a little bit after that, it started to come up into the United States. And it came up the eastern seaboard and landed in Philadelphia. But really, the big production of poinsettias started out in Southern California, and it was a field-grown crop, just like a nursery where they're growing shrubs in the ground, and then they'll dig them up like bare root. That's how actually poinsettias started. And then over time, again, the more this development happened in California, and we started to grow them in containers and in a greenhouse.
So did they have to change a lot to be, I guess, domesticated?
Absolutely. When you take something that naturally is, you know, many feet tall, basically a shrub or a sub-tree, and you try to fit it in a 6-inch pot, there's lots of things that you need to do to accommodate that plant. Well, the good part is we learned how to do a lot of these tricks in the greenhouse. So one of them is we can control the flowering of a plant. So unlike in nature where you have to wait until the natural flowering season, we can promote or inhibit flowering the poinsettia just by controlling the light during the day and the dark period at night. And so growers can induce the flower to bloom before it gets too large for the container. But we also do certain things. In plants, there are hormones that will promote cell elongation. That's going to make a plant taller. Well, there are things that we can apply to plants that will suppress the formation of those hormones and keep the plant a little shorter.
All right. And there's also a virus that's been introduced into poinsettias, right?
Purposefully. What's really interesting is when you see these poinsettias in their native habitat, they grow straight up. Real tall branches or real tall stems with very little branching. But generally for a potted plant, we want to have branching on that plant because it's going to fill out the plant and make it look more attractive. And poinsettias, they started to observe that certain poinsettias were very free branching and made very nice plants. Well, it ended up being that it was a virus that was causing this. So now when a new attractive poinsettia is bred and the growers like the brack color, they will graft a poinsettia that's infected with that virus onto the desirable colored poinsettia that maybe doesn't have that free branching quality. And then it gets transmitted, and then it has that free branching characteristic.
How do they propagate them, given that they have to make sure that they have this virus and all of that?
Well, now it's pretty much going to be in all the breeding lines, and all the parents are going to have it. So now it's pretty well in the plant. But actually, for the North American market, the vast majority of our poinsettias are propagated by vegetative tip cuttings, just like you may see if you take a cutting of a pothos vine or a geranium and stick it in a glass of water. That's a tip cutting. We use tip cuttings for poinsettias as well, and those are primarily grown in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua as well. And then they're shipped up to greenhouse growers as early as sometimes June, depending on how large they need to have the plant by Christmas.
Well, and I can imagine, we were talking about controlling the light. Greenhouses tend to be translucent. How do the growers control the light to make sure that they bloom on time?
Well, what we do is we use a system called blackout cloth. And what happens is it's fairly common now to see poinsettias right around Thanksgiving time. Well, a poinsettia won't naturally induce its flower until about the third week of September. But in order to hit that Thanksgiving market, we need to start creating shorter days and longer nights earlier. So what happens is in the afternoon, greenhouses will retract or cover their greenhouse with a black cloth that will then shut out all of the natural light and trick the plant into thinking it's nighttime.
All right. So it's a really labor-intensive process, it sounds
well,
like.
Well, it used to be a labor-intensive process, but now a lot of those greenhouse curtains are going to be automated and we no longer have people pulling them by hand.
Do you have an idea of how large the market is for poinsettias?
Poinsettias are, for flowering potted plants, the second most valuable flowering potted plant behind orchids. There are more poinsettias produced than orchids, but orchids do have a higher value per unit.
Oh, fascinating. Do you know why we associate them with Christmas?
Well, because it's that naturally short day and that long and uninterrupted night that causes flowering. So just like the Thanksgiving Christmas cactus, they get these names because in nature, down in southern Mexico and Guatemala, that would be their native time for flowering. And so they were developing these flowers and red bracts around Christmas. And so we just adopted that and brought it up north.
Now, of course, we'd love to have some color this time of year. That's why we bring in the Christmas tree, because it's green and vibrant when everything else is cold and snowy, and the poinsettia kind of fills the same purpose. With so many people wanting them in their homes, do you know how many people are working on creating new versions of the poinsettia? Are you talking about some of the different versions that have come out?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, we've actually seen a consolidation in the number of poinsettia breeders in the most recent years. And so there's not as much breeding for the poinsettia as there formerly was. A lot of breeding efforts have now gone into the spring annual market because that tends to be a much larger market for greenhouse growers. Because to a certain extent, poinsettias have gotten commoditized.
Now, tell me about how to take care of a poinsettia. Once you get it into your office or your home, they tend to be pretty low maintenance, but are there some tips?
Well, one thing you want to do is, since the poinsettia does come from a subtropical environment, it's somewhat sensitive to cold temperatures. And so if you, first of all, let's start at the store, make sure you get a sleeve around the plant, either a plastic sleeve or a paper sleeve, because when you take it out of the store into your car, depending on the weather, we don't want to blast it with cool temperatures. And once you get inside the home, the same holds. Don't place it right by your front door where you're going to get gusts of cold wind when your guests come in for your holiday events, or don't put it by too drafty a window. We don't want to get the poinsettia much colder than 55 or 50 degree air temperatures.
All right. Now, one of the things that I have a really hard time with is letting them go after the holidays, because they still look wonderful. They're beautiful. It's a vibrant living plant. What's your advice for those of us that have a hard time saying goodbye?
My advice is that you should practice saying goodbye and support the Iowa greenhouse industry. You can hold on to the plant and you can try to reflower it, but I can guarantee that our Iowa greenhouse growers do a great job of growing a high-quality crop each year. And the amount of effort you're going to have to go to bringing it into your closet at 5 o'clock at night and remembering to bring it out at 9 a.m. the next morning, that I think it's worth the price of a new one.
And do we grow a lot in Iowa?
Yeah, we have a number of really great poinsettia growers in Iowa. And so this is a great time to go to the greenhouses and see all those plants really colorful, especially when you come in from those cooler outdoor temperatures. But some of our biggest growers tend to be wholesale growers, so they may not be facilities that you're going to be able to visit right as a retail consumer.
I'm talking with Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Also here, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. It is Horticulture Day. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. And your questions don't have to be about holiday plants. Terry is on the line next. Hi, Terry. Terry, are you there? Oh, Terry may have wandered away from the phone. We'll check in with Terry and see if we can get them on the line. Steve is up next in Fairbank. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I have a plant that was my mother's. It's probably about 43 years old, and she told me it was a Christmas cactus, but I'm not sure that it is, and I was wondering how to tell it the difference between it and other cactuses and how to get it to flower, because it's only flowered like probably twice in the last 10 years.
Okay. Well, I've got a couple of questions to identify this cactus. Does it not look like a traditional barrel cactus type look? Does it have kind of stems that hang over and hang down?
Yes, it looks like more like a succulent than a cactus.
Okay, then you most likely do have a Christmas cactus. And now what those are those little stem segments are actually called phylloclades. And that's a good indicator that it's a Christmas cactus. Now, one of the reasons that it may not be flowering is where it's located. Could you describe where in your house you have the plant?
It's in a east-facing window with kind of sheer drapes, so it's getting kind of a medium light.
Okay, and is this a room that in the evening you'll be have a reading light on or watching the television?
Yes.
Okay, well, it goes back to that day length. Very similar to the poinsettia, the Thanksgiving or the Christmas cactus is induced to flower by short days. Now, what's happening is that as the day gets short, we turn on our lights to watch TV, read books, etc., and that's extending the day length, and they're not getting that short, uninterrupted, or that long, uninterrupted dark period. So one thing you can do is try to move it to a room that you maybe don't have as much activity at night. Another really interesting thing is that that response to day length is modified by temperature. And when you have cool temperatures, it actually is less affected by day length. So you may be able to put it by a window, put it by that window I was telling to keep the poinsettias away from, that drafty window that may get it cooler. And then it's going to potentially flower even if you do have some light in the evening.
Okay, that sounds good. The other question I had is, it's been in this same small pot for 43 years or so, and every once in a while I give it a little miracle grow. Is that the thing to do?
Well, it likes to be pot-bound, so that's not a problem. But 40 years, I think it might be time to repot it. I would just get a slightly bigger pot, maybe an inch or two in diameter, nothing huge, and make sure you have a good, well-drained potting soil. It likes that. And I would probably repot it in the spring of the year where you can bring it outside, maybe do it outside. And as far as fertilization, you typically want to fertilize during the period when it's growing, typically in the spring and summer. And I would just use a dilute fertilizer solution like Miracle-Gro.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State, and DNR District Forester Mark Bitosh. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we've been talking a lot about holiday plants so far this hour, but we are here to answer your questions about the plants in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and DNR District Forester Mark Bitosh. And let's go back to the phones. Terry is on the line this time. Hi, Terry. I hope so. Terry, are you there? We seem to have lost her again. All right. Never mind. Sorry, Terry. One last chance. Okay, let's go to Jan in Iowa City. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I grew a gorgeous red amaryllis for Christmas last year, and I oversummered it, let the leaves grow, then turned it on its side when the leaves started to turn yellow, and that was about 5 or 6 weeks ago. But now when I looked up online, it says it needs to be cooled as well. So I'm wondering, should I have just put it in a cool spot right away when I turned it over, and do I still need to cool it now for how long before I can replant it?
Right. Basically, for that bulb to initiate a flower, it needs to be exposed to temperatures in the 50 to 55 degree range, and that needs to be for basically 8 weeks or so.
Wow.
And so without that, it's not going to bloom. It's going to maybe rest, but it's not going to develop that flower bud. So it needs that 8 to 9 week period where the temperature is consistently around 50 to 55.
Can it be in the refrigerator?
No, way too cold. No. So you try to find a cool place. It might be maybe a unused bedroom. It might be a cool porch or someplace.
Right.
But it has to be consistently in the 50 to 55 degree range. If it gets below freezing, it's going to be toast. It's going to be dead. So
it has to be in that
50 to 55 range.
But if it goes steady at around 40, is that going to work or no?
No, I don't think so. It's a little bit too cold.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I guess I'll have an Easter amaryllis this year.
All right. Good luck,
thank
Jan.
You.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Michelle in Guthrie Center. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, we are going to get a real tree for the first time this year, and just trying to figure out the best way to care for it during the holiday season. And I've been reading suggestions to add sugar to the water or to buy some fertilizers, and I'm just wondering, do those things really make a difference in extending the life of the tree?
I should probably answer this because I did that once several years ago. I saw this recipe in the newspaper, and I added sugar and several other things. It sounded terrific. It sounded right. But then several days later, I started to smell something. And this smell got worse and worse. And so eventually I had to crawl underneath there with a turkey baster and remove the water and get rid of it. So just use water, basically.
Okay.
The thing to think about, the vessels that pick up the water are very tiny, tiny, tiny. And so any large particles are not going to be picked up by that tree anyway through their vascular system. So water is the key. And just don't let it run out.
That's great.
All right, Michelle, thanks a lot for your call. And here's a related question from Matt in Mason City. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Hi. We were just talking about sugar in the water. What's your question?
That was pretty much the same thing. I was just asking about, they had the Sprite and things like that. I know my parents always said, oh, yeah, put some 7-Up or Sprite in there, and I was wondering if that was good for it.
And is that what you tried, Richard, or did you try?
No, it was sugar and two or three other things, but it started to really ferment and just smell just horrible. So don't add anything. Sometimes people would use maybe Sprite for maybe trying to preserve cut flowers or something of that nature, but just add the water. That's all it really needs. So
okay. And then my next question is, we grow row trees, basically. Norwegian spruce, and we've been planting them. We stagger them from year to year, and we've planted them, and some of them have, you know, took off. They're, and within a couple of years, they're already, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet high. And then there's just certain spots where they won't grow, and now we've replanted. I mean, we'll pull the old one out, and we replant it, try it again, and then they still won't take. And it is sandy soil, but is there something else in there that would cause that issue that they wouldn't really grow in that spot?
It's probably the sand, Matt. I mean, they like moist, well-drained soils. And if you get some really sandier spots, Norway spruce isn't going to do as well. And that's in any typical windbreak or row planting or anything like that, no matter what species it is, we all know that you can go 10 feet one direction and the soil tends to change depending on what the past activities were and stuff like that. So that's a very common challenge, and in some cases you may just have a spot that you're not going to get something to grow as well. Now, if you can take some diversity and you got some room, you may try like a white pine. They're going to adapt to that sandier soil a little better. Or even, we talked about eastern red cedar earlier, it may not fit as well in the landscape that you want it, but if it's a sandier soil, those will probably adapt to those conditions better.
Okay, yeah, because we have, 40-foot-high red pine all around it. And
right.
So I was just wondering if it was the tree or for the species or if it's just soil, so it sounds like just the soil.
Yeah, and it's the species itself. Again, Norway spruce will tend to prefer that kind of loamy, moist, well-drained soil. And if you start to get to those sandier soils, it's going to have a tougher time because red pine is actually very adaptive to lighter, sandier soils. That's why they're doing so well.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Yeah, Matt, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Robert in Illinois. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, as I understand it, all plants that contain green foliage absorb carbon dioxide from the air. And as a result of photosynthesis, one of the byproducts is to release oxygen. Once you cut down the tree, those processes stop. No more carbon dioxide absorbed, no more oxygen released. And slow process of decay sets in, and one of the processes of decay is more carbon dioxide. Whether you just let it rot on a leaf pile or if you burn it, more carbon dioxide. Since this is something in the news almost every hour of every day, wouldn't it be nice just as a gesture to the planet to, instead of cutting down trees for Christmas trees, why not just plant a new tree or go out and look at the live ones?
All right. Well, Robert, I know a lot of people who actually do take that approach. But, Mark, I know you spend most of your time planting trees and taking care of trees that have been planted. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
And one thing to support that, and I think that's a great point, Robert, and actually some people try to plant live trees and take them back out, or they decorate trees in the yard and stuff like that. The one thing that happens in the Christmas tree industry is they're planting for every tree that they cut, they're planting two or three more. So they're not, it's not a negative on that. They're adding more trees each time, and millions and millions and millions of trees are planted every year and replanted every year as those trees are replaced. I know you're adding some carbon, but they're replanting those trees to try to take in more oxygen, or release more oxygen.
Chris, was that you?
Yeah. Also, let's not forget, when you take that tree down and you cut it down, what's left in the ground is a massive root system. So much like our prairie, the root system acts as a huge carbon sink, so is that big root system that's still in the ground. So the tree still has contributed to sequestering some carbon.
And I'll be honest, this is a subject I've wrestled with quite a bit, and I've gone back and forth. And
it's a great point.
Part of what I've tried to take into consideration, too, is that it is an agricultural product as well. I mean, living in Michigan for 10 years, there are lots and lots of Christmas tree farmers there, which kind of changed my perspective on it.
Well, and the thing to think about, too, is those young developing trees actually are better in taking carbon. As trees get older, they don't take as much in. They don't produce as much oxygen. So that younger developing plantation is very productive from that sense, too.
So it's a question definitely worth asking.
Great question, Robert.
Yeah, Robert, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Karen is on the line in Carroll. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I just have a quick question about my Christmas cactus, and then I have another question about a pom-pom pine that I have in my front yard. But my Christmas cactus has a bloom on it, and I'm have kind of neglected it in a way and not – I know I'm not doing what I should, but if I want it to bloom at Christmas, so I've already got a bloom on it, and I'm thinking, will it be blooming still at Christmas? I don't know.
Now, is it a fully open flower, or is it sort of a puffy, pinkish-reddish bud?
It's a fully opened flower, but the other ends only look like they're just maybe thinking about it.
Okay, well, what's happening is at the tip of that phylloclade, that modified leaf, that's where the buds are going to be formed. So what happened is, depending on what part of the plant that flower is on, the other side of the plant may come into flower just a bit later, because that other side may have been in dark longer. And this is something we'll see with garden mums on a street light. The street light is interrupting that night, so half of the plant blooms later, whereas on the back side of that street light, the plant is darker and it flowers more quickly. But unfortunately, okay, I would suggest that you just really enjoy that flower now. Christmas cactus flowers aren't the longest-lived flowers.
Okay.
It's close.
And I will say, most of my holiday cacti are almost done blooming. So they started blooming around the 1st of November. So their clocks are not precise. They kind of bloom sometime in late fall, early winter. And mine are about done for the year. So.
And a lot of the plants that we see on the market are going to be hybrids of the Thanksgiving cactus and the Christmas cactus. And again, as you could infer by the name, they have a different bloom period. So as we hybridize, that starts to get a little bit less clear on the flowering time.
All right. And what was your question about the pine tree?
It.
Yeah, Karen?
Okay. Now, my pom-pom pine is my biggest concern every year because I just had new landscaping done probably 5 years ago. And I was talked into this pom-pom pine, and I didn't think I'd like anything like it. You know, it's globs of circles. I don't like that kind of stuff. But I looked online, and I saw a pom-pom pine that looks more like a bonsai tree. And I fell in love with that look, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do with it. And I've been afraid of it every year. And I used to work at a Christmas tree farm, so I get all the things about trimming a little bit, so I'm excited to talk to somebody that knows. I can't see the underlying structure of the tree very good because it's prickly and hard to get at, but it has grown huge, and I'm worried that it's too late for me to do much to it.
All right. Well, we've got, I think Mark's got a puzzled look.
I do too. You can't see that, but I do.
Because you don't know what a pom-pom pine is necessarily?
Right.
Well, it kind of depends on what species of
tree it is.
If it's a juniper type or if it's a true pine, because I've seen, and I'm looking at some different pictures online here, I think there's potential of different species that could be used to develop that kind of look.
Now, does this tree have a true distinct needle? Like a two or three inch needle?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
But
it looks like a Christmas tree, and it doesn't quite look exactly like my picture that I have. My picture looks a little more stubby, and but
is it one needle or two needles in a bundle? And what I mean by bundle, at the end of the needles, there should be a little, it's called a fascicle, it's a little sheath that holds the needles together in a group, if you look back on the twig, versus is it scaly or just one individual needle?
It's one individual needle, and then at the very end of the branch, it's got a bunch of buddy-looking things.
So it could be some type of
looking at it right
spruce
now.
Or fir.
To me, it's almost like a Scotch pine, only the needles are longer.
Okay. Well, if it's a Scotch pine and that's one of the ones that does get used for that purpose, there should be two needles in a bundle on that.
Needles in a bundle.
So,
I mean,
if you look
at the tip.
Right
on it. I opened my window.
If you look at the tip of the needle and you go down towards the branch itself, they should be in groups of two. They should be attached together and wrapped in a little sheath at the base of those needles. That'll tell you.
Yeah, they actually are.
Okay. Yep. So we're probably looking at some type of pine, Richard.
Okay.
Probably a Scotch.
And how long has it grown without being pruned or sheared?
We got that.
Oh, my gosh. I knew you were going to ask.
Because if it's been several years.
I think about 5 years. I really
It's going to be hard to bring it back.
Right. It's going to be hard to bring it back because it's grown. Typically, you'd probably have to do this every single year to keep that shape to it. And if it's been growing basically unpruned, unsheared for 3 or 4 years, I think you've kind of lost that shape at this point. And it's going to be hard to bring it back.
Okay. So, but I still can make it shorter, can I? I mean.
Well, you can definitely prune it or shear it. Yes, you can from this point on.
I know that it's important not to go into the dead wood, but how much pruning can I do?
Well, for example, you could go out there in the spring when the candles, that new growth begins to develop, and let's say the candle is 2 or 3 inches in length. You can pinch out the upper half of that and drastically reduce the growth rate of the plant if you want.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely want it to stop growing so much. It just seems to be.
And wouldn't you say, Richard, by mid-June or so, she'd want to complete that practice?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
All right. Well, Karen, good luck with that. That sounds like a big project. let's get to a couple email questions. We're nearly out of time. Is it late enough to prune oak, Mark?
Yes.
It is. All right.
It was very frosty this morning on my way to work on the bike, and we've had some good low temperatures and stuff. I realize, actually, I think this weekend would be a great time. Who doesn't want to be out in 40-degree temps pruning trees and dragging branches and all that stuff? So I would go ahead and prune those, and I would get it done before March 1st, unless we get weather change, and we'll talk about it when we get close to March.
All right, and we were talking about holiday cacti. What's a good watering cycle?
Kind of depends upon the potting soil, but I would say probably do it thoroughly every week or 10 days.
All right, and this is a question from Lauren. She says, what causes a Christmas cactus to drop buds? Does moving the plant cause a problem?
It can be any sort of stress that can drop them prematurely, so a cold draft or some sort of sudden change in environment.
Keep it nice and calm around the Christmas cactus, right? Chris Curry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Mark Vitosh, thank you very much.
Thank you. You as always.
DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. We had production assistance from Patrick Lenan. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Have a great weekend.